It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about a time when players for the Green Bay Packers were just part of everyday life in Green Bay.
First, we have updates on two stories in northern Wisconsin.
Six counties that were hardest hit by flooding in June have received a federal disaster declaration. Parts of Bayfield County got 15 inches of rain in 3 days. The flooding caused $13 million in damage to public infrastructure across Bayfield and five other counties.
Also, two people have been found guilty of crimes following their protest at an oil pipeline construction site in Superior last summer. One of them was also sentenced to time in jail.
WPR reporter Danielle Kading has been following both of those stories and is here now to bring us up to speed. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How you doing?
Good. Well, let's start with the flooding. Talk about the counties that were declared federal disaster areas.
Yeah, sure. Six counties in northern Wisconsin received a federal disaster declaration, and that was after flooding in June around the 15th through the 19th. There was, as you said, a lot of rain that fell across northern Wisconsin, and that caused roughly $13 million in damage to public infrastructure, like roads. And so Governor Scott Walker announced on Friday that the federal government would be declaring a disaster area for Ashland, Bayfield, Burnett, Clark, Douglas, and Iron counties. So basically, that's good news for northern Wisconsin because it means more money and more help to repair those roads and the damage.
Yeah, can you talk a little more about what the declaration will mean for those counties?
Yeah, Bayfield County Emergency Management Director Jan Victorson says they had around $3.9 million in damage. So this is what she had to say about that federal disaster declaration.
This is huge. Our towns are low population areas that figured out to be, if we were to have every person in our county contribute in order to make the repairs, it was estimated it would be over $250 per person. So in terms of the tax levy, that would have been huge for our small towns.
And Danny, that's probably not the only place with that story where a community to repair the damages, it would be more than they spend on an annual budget.
Yeah, in fact, Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler said virtually the same thing, and here's what he had to say.
Well, in some of these towns, the loss that they're suffered on the highways exceeds their actual annual operations budget. They've got nowhere to get the money. I mean, they have to borrow the money and then figure out how to pay it back.
And this is a pretty common story in northern Wisconsin right now. If you think about it, this is the third federal disaster declaration for northern Wisconsin in the last 6 years because of flooding. So towns in the area have been looking to borrowing from banks and from they've been looking for money from the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands and wherever they can get it to try and pay for a lot of this damage.
And I imagine that people in local governments there were probably biting their fingernails for the last couple of months to see if they got this federal help.
Yeah, there was some concern initially whether or not northern Wisconsin would qualify for federal funding because there's a certain amount of damage that would have to be reached. I think it's around $8 million before they could qualify for any kind of federal assistance. So knowing that this money is coming means that the federal government will pay about 75% of the cost to repair roads or public infrastructure, and the state will chip in 12.5%, which means that towns and local governments have much less to pay than they would have if the federal government had not granted them a disaster declaration.
Danny, we talked to you shortly after the flooding had happened there, but to remind us, paint us a picture of the kind of infrastructure damage we saw in those counties.
You know, it's significant, but it's not unusual, I guess. I feel sad to say that, but the kind of damage that we're seeing has been typical of the last several floods. We're seeing road washouts that have disrupted traffic and caused long-term detours. Last year, it was U.S. Highway 63 near Grandview, where I think that was shut down around this time. That was shut down for about a month. And right now, U.S. Highway 2, there's still a detour around a washout there by North Fish Creek, which is about 20 minutes away from Ashland. But they are on track to open that back up again by the end of the month. And that's a roughly $2 million project for the state.
Is there any talk that these repairs can at least in some way be used for flood proofing to try to prevent more damage next time?
Yeah, you know, with this federal disaster declaration, it opens the possibility to repair roads beyond what was lost, meaning if a road had, say, an 18-inch culvert, well, maybe they could upsize that to 36 inches so that it could handle more water flowing through it and maybe wouldn't undermine the road. So they're looking at things like that and other ways that they could potentially reduce flood risks, like maybe doing things like wetland ponds or detention basins and spillways. So there are some things that are being considered right now or worked on right now.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, looking at a couple of big stories from northern Wisconsin. Let's shift gears now to the Enbridge pipeline and a court case involving protesters there. What's the latest, Danny?
So yesterday, 24-year-old Alexander Goodcanemilk and 26-year-old Kyla Hassig appeared in Douglas County Court. They were charged with disorderly conduct and obstructing an officer, and they were also charged with trespassing because they went to the Enbridge construction site for the Line 3 replacement project, which is an aging oil pipeline that Enbridge Energy owns. They were looking to replace a 12.5-mile segment of that line. And during that work last summer, these two individuals went to that site. Alexander Goodcanemilk basically secured himself to a piece of excavation equipment. And Kyla Hassig live streamed video of them protesting on social media. And they argued, or their attorneys argued, that essentially they felt they had no other alternative but to do this, that other methods to try and stop the pipeline had failed, such as going to meetings or doing letter writing campaigns or petitions. And so they felt like they were backed into a corner and that this was the only way that they could make a point, essentially, I guess. District Attorney Mark Fruhoff, Douglas County District Attorney Mark Fruhoff, said basically that, you know, they're not bad people, but if they weren't held accountable for their crimes, he felt like he was giving license to them or anyone who thinks they have a cause worthy enough to break the law. And here's more of what he had to say about that.
The state's case was that their whole plan with this was to cause a disruption, to cause disorder, to engage in disorderly conduct, to bring awareness to their cause. And then when law enforcement told them they had to, you know, they were under arrest, they had to come down off the equipment, they disobeyed, and law enforcement had to go to some extra steps to take them into custody, and that's obstructing.
And then you also had some audio from one of the attorneys. Can you set that up for us?
Yeah, sure. Attorney John Bachman, he's a private practice attorney out of Eau Claire. He was representing Alexander Goodcanemilk. And basically, he disagreed with the district attorney's argument that, you know, finding them guilty of those crimes would, in effect, give license to people to break the law for a cause that they found worthy enough. And this is what he had to say about that.
You're not going to have a lot of people running out there tomorrow to try to do the same thing. I mean, having these trials and going through all this is very complicated, it's costly, it's expensive, it's nerve-wracking, it's tiring, and it takes a good deal of time out of people's lives. And as Ralph said, each case is judged individually. Even if they were acquitted, somebody could go out there tomorrow, do the same thing, and they could get convicted. That's not license. The justice system still works.
And he was also making the argument that they weren't acting in their own self-interest, that they were in fact doing this out of concern for the environment and for others because they believed that the pipeline and that climate change were significant issues that caused, as Kyla Hassig said it during her sentencing yesterday, an imminent danger to people.
So both found guilty. Can you talk about one of them sentenced, one still to be sentenced? Do I have that right?
Yes, yes. Kyla Hassig was sentenced by Douglas County Judge Kelly Tim yesterday evening, and he said during her sentencing that he would have been inclined to just dole out straight fines for what happened. But the fact that she did not comply with officers' requests to come off the site voluntarily, that she had to be forcibly removed, he said that put her and officers at risk, and that he wanted to send a message to her that that behavior will not be tolerated.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Danny, are we expecting to see more protests at the site?
No, because the Line 3 construction site in Superior is finished. They have finished that project in Wisconsin, and it is now in service in Wisconsin. But as we all know, that debate is still panning out in Minnesota, and so we'll see what happens with challenges to finishing that project there.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter in Superior. We talked with her about the ongoing flood recovery efforts in northern Wisconsin and guilty verdicts for two protesters at an Enbridge oil pipeline construction site. Right now, football stars, the big stars today, are paid in the millions of dollars, and a lot of them have lifestyles that reflect that, with multi-million dollar mansions and luxury townhomes. But according to our next guest, the Green Bay Packers of the classic 1960s era lived a more humble lifestyle, and they were part of everyday life in Green Bay.
Richard Ryman reports on the business and non-football news of the Green Bay Packers for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. He recently wrote about that period of the team's history. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So what prompted you to start looking into the housing that Packers had during the Lombardi era in the 1960s?
Well, these things kind of evolve sometime. I did a story about Jordy Nelson selling his house here, and it went over very well with readers. And so we started thinking about other things that we might do in Packers housing, and that sort of led us into a discussion of why the Lombardi Packers are this sort of mythical bunch of guys. And we decided part of it was probably because they lived, you know, amongst everybody. Green Bay is not so large that the Packers players don't still live, you know, close to everybody. You can't hide here. But they're much more in the suburbs. And, you know, they've got more money so they can afford to live in a little higher end places. The Lombardi guys were just next door to you. And we kind of thought that probably played a part in, you know, how they're thought of these days as well.
Well, I think part of the reason that this story is so interesting is because, as you said, the Packers in the 1960s lived in neighborhoods that were, you know, right next to kind of everyday people. And the houses, looking at some of the pictures that are included with your piece, they really do look like just standard middle class homes, not the mansions we might expect today. Can you describe some of those homes for us?
Well, they're like you say, they're just sort of the kind of homes you see in the older part of Green Bay. Ranches, primarily, 2 and 3 bedrooms. Some of them are just kind of little square places. Not really very special at all, though, you know, for the players then, we're kind of looking back on them, and, you know, they probably were better then than we think they are now. And some of them, like Jerry Kramer, built their own. So they were able to make them look like they wanted to, but they were just normal houses.
And was that because the players' salaries were just not as inflated or extravagant as they are today? What were they making compared to, say, their other neighbors?
Well, they were generally on par with the other neighbors. They may have been making a little bit more, I think. Bob Skoronski, for instance, his wife Ruth said they were making $8,000 when he signed with the Packers in the late 50s. Jerry Kramer talked about making $9,000, which I looked up like the average salary here, and it was in the $6,000 or $7,000 range in those days. But you're also talking about the players having to live in two different places often because they had to get jobs in the off season, and so doing that meant sometimes they would go back home. So $9,000 didn't stretch very far when you're trying to live in two different communities.
I think just that idea that players were, you know, having a job on the off season is just so foreign to us today.
It is. You know, you don't think about that very often, but like Carol Dale sold sporting goods equipment for a while, and Jim Grabowski, I think, may have sold insurance for a while, but, you know, they were all doing something in the off season. But it's surprising how fast it changed. I mean, the modern NFL that we're dealing with now came about really in the 1990s, but even by the end of the Lombardi era, Donnie Anderson talked about the fact that he didn't have what he would call a regular off-season job. He did a lot of appearances and corporate events and stuff that, you know, was an off-season job, but it wasn't like having to go to some place 9 to 5 every day. And he talked about making money in a range of $20,000 to $50,000.
Wow. So that was starting to get up there.
Right. And he came along, before or was there for the last two Super Bowls, and Super Bowl money was pretty good.
Right. So the bonuses really helped bring their salaries up.
And Kramer talks about that. He said that was a discussion in the locker room amongst the guys that, you know, they were counting on this money and that was part of their motivation to win championships.
So you did speak with some of the former Packers of that era, and I thought it was really interesting that depending on how the team was doing, their experience of living in the heart of Green Bay and among their fans could be a little different depending on, you know, the most recent score.
It did affect the neighborhood a little bit, I think. You know, that Carol Dale talks about stopping at the gas station to fill up and people would be complaining because they scored too many or too few points and ruined their pool. or the kids would get, you know, a little bit of harassment at school if they didn't play. If the Packers didn't play very well, which Dale said, you know, it was good that they didn't lose very often.
I do think it's really interesting that you talked about kids. And, you know, like any kids, there were kids going to play at the homes of some of the Packers and Packer kids going to other kids' homes. And for them, it was like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, that my friend's dad plays on the Packers or is the coach of the Packers. But, you know, it's like, but what's really important is, you know, they have the best swing set.
Yeah, Carol Lacombe probably had one of the best quotes in the whole series. She went to school with Susan Lombardi, Vince Lombardi's daughter. And she said, you know, he was just some Packers coach. He was no big deal. Which is awfully hard to reconcile from this point of view, but you know she was an eighth grader, seventh grader, and he was a dad. That was all there was to it.
Rich Ryman reports on the business and non-football news of the Green Bay Packers for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. And Rich, I think it's important for us to remember what the 1960s were like. There was a lot of racial tension, and of course, there were African American players on the Packers who were living and working in the city before 1968 when the Civil Rights Act went into effect. What was their experience like, and what influence did Vince Lombardi have on that?
Well, they talk about Green Bay being a better place than a lot of places in the country at that time to be. But, you know, that's doesn't mean it was a great place necessarily if you were black. They had still to face a lot of indignities here. It's even small things that we might think weren't that bad, but having somebody come up to you and saying, can I touch your hair or can I touch your children's hair, because they'd never seen anything like mm-hmm. that. I mean, that's still pretty off-putting. And originally they couldn't rent in the city of Green Bay for a couple reasons. One is landlords did not have to rent to them because there was no Fair Housing Act, but also Green Bay didn't have a lot of apartments and things in those days, so the inventory was not great either. You know, they called it a strange but not menacing place to be. On the plus side, they had Vince Lombardi as a coach, and Lombardi was famous for being completely non-discriminatory. I mean, to him, Packers were Packers. That mm-hmm. was all that mattered. And when he discovered that some of the black players were living in really subpar conditions, he went to Dominic Oleniczek, who was president of the Packers, and said, you know, we can't have this. If we want these good players to come here, we have to provide them places to live that are decent. And the word went out in town, and there were people and landlords who stepped up. And as apartments became available and houses became available, black players were able to get better living conditions.
And before we wrap up, Rich, I wanted to ask you about some of these houses that are still standing. Obviously, they've been bought probably and sold several times since this era, but there are people living in these houses now, and some of them didn't even know the history when they bought them.
Some did not. They found out afterwards. A neighbor or a family member said, hey, do you know you're living in Henry Jordan's house? And they didn't know that. Others are well aware of it. The folks who own what was Vince Lombardi's house or Bart Starr's house, there's no escaping that. Unfortunately, fans can be a little zealous sometimes, and they'll look out their door and see people playing catch on their lawn, or some of them have even been known to knock on the door and say, can we come in and look around? So there is a downside to that too. But a lot of these houses still have some of those Packers touches in it, some of the things that the players did when they lived there. And if you're a Packers fan, and the majority of people in Green Bay are, I mean, that's sort of a badge of honor in the neighborhood or amongst your friends.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for sharing these stories with us. It's a really great little peek into Packers history.
Thank you.
That was Richard Ryman, a reporter who covers business and non-football news of the Green Bay Packers for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us to talk about the lives of Lombardi-era Packers in the 1960s. First, advice columnists like Dear Abby, Ann Landers, and Miss Manners are probably familiar to you.
But what about Lord Chesterfield or William Alcott? And are people like Benjamin Franklin and Dale Carnegie part of that group?
Americans are fascinated by advice columns and have been for 300 years. Jessica Weisberg traces that history in her new book, Asking for a Friend, 3 centuries of advice on life, love, money, and other burning questions from a nation obsessed. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what are the basic elements of an advice column?
Well, a big component of the advice column is that people stay anonymous. And I think that was the large appeal of them for many years. When the first advice column came out in 1690 in England, it was a rare chance for people to ask any question they wanted to and to not suffer any shame for it. And that was a really huge appeal. And I think that advice columnists early on really saw that this really freed people up to sort of share their darkest questions. And I think that trend has really continued today on the internet.
And the title of your book is Asking for a Friend. Did people often pose their questions as, well, this isn't about me, but I'm concerned about someone close to me?
Of course they did. And, there's that level of obfuscation that really allows people to ask the questions that are really burning in their hearts.
According to the subtitle of your book, we've been turning to advice columnists or advice givers for 300 years, even a little more than that. What are some of the examples of the earliest ones?
Sure. So I mentioned John Dunton already. John Dunton, I would say, is the creator of the form. And he started a newsletter in 1690 in England. And he started it with his 2 brothers-in-laws, but they pretended that they were sort of 26 wise men. And people kind of fought it for a long time. And people asked them all sorts of questions about religion and God and the cosmos. And they largely made things up. But I think they also gave people great comfort because they could ask questions about sex and love and relationships that they maybe weren't that comfortable bringing to their pastor. And then other ones in America that I include later on is Lord Chesterfield, who was an etiquette writer who wrote a book that sort of became a bestseller in America right around the time of the American Revolution. And another one I write about early on in the book is William Alcott, who is an early dieting expert.
Tell us more about that. What were people asking advice on about dieting way back then?
Sure. Well, William Alcott was a strong believer that the vegetarian diet was not only the healthiest thing for you physiologically, but also the healthiest thing for you spiritually. And he had a real political bent to his idea on diet. He thought that if more Americans became vegetarian, slavery would end. And there was a practical part of this argument because he just thought that, like, a lot of the animal products came from the South. But then there was just a more spiritual aspect of the of his argument, that by sort of thinking about the suffering of animals, you would also be thinking about the suffering of human beings. So he really argued that the vegetarian diet would sort of allow you to live forever, and it would make you bring you a better communion with God and sort of a better society overall. And I think what was sort of interesting about him, and I think in a way he's sort of a predecessor for a lot of the diet crazes we see today, is it's so much more about diet. It's about lifestyle and about community and about making the world a better place. And you hear a lot of that in a lot of the diets that are marketed to us today.
Tell us about the 19th century, because there was so much going on, societal changes, industrial revolution. You just talked about the South, the Civil War. What did the advice column or the predecessors of the advice column look like in the 19th century?
Sure. The 19th century, there was, I think in the 19th century, there was, right after the Civil War, there was a huge surge in the popularity of spiritualists. And a lot of the reason for that was because a lot of people lost loved ones during the Civil War, and they wanted people to help who could sort of bridge the gap between themselves and the dead. And so I think there was a lot in the sort of the late 19th century, a lot of spiritualists and a lot of advice that sort of allowed you to sort of connect with someone who was deceased. And I think that it was sort of a predecessor for a lot of the advice I think we see today. I think astrology has become more popular. I live in New York City and there are psychics on every other block. And so you really see that in the 19th century. And the other thing that starts in the 19th century is that a lot of these spiritualists were women. And then as the 20th century starts, you see many more women giving advice in sort of prominent publications. And the earliest chapter of the book, the sort of revolutionary period and before, it's always men. It's always white men giving people advice on how to live. And then what you see throughout the book is sort of the inclusion of more women giving that, being put in that position of power. And as time goes on, that the sort of it becomes a field that's accessible to more people.
Jessica Weisberg is an award-winning writer and producer. We're talking about her new book, which is Asking for a Friend, Three Centuries of Advice on Life, Love, Money, and Other Burning Questions from a Nation Obsessed. And Jessica, you just took us into the 20th century, and it seems like in many ways the advice columns really blossomed last century. Why do you think that was? You said that women became the more prominent advice givers. Were there other factors that you think led to that?
Yeah, I think there were. I think there were a lot of changes for women in the 20th century. And you see a lot of the advice columnists I profile in the book sort of on the cutting edge of those changes. The first woman that I profile from the 20th century, she was right at the turn of the 20th century, and she wrote under the pen name Dorothy Dix. And you can really see her sort of fielding questions from women who are, you know, just grappling with whether they want to become a suffragist and grappling with the decision about working and whether a wife should work. And there's lots of questions about abortion and reproductive rights and marriage. And I think it was, you know, the 20th century was a huge time for women's rights. And you really see people sort of trying to suss out what's normal and what's right and what's weird, and looking to advice columnists to sort of suss out the norms of our society as they change.
Well, and that's one thing I really wondered about is whether advice columns tended to shore up the prevailing cultural positions and norms, or if they played a role in changing attitudes.
That's a really good question. And I think that one of the things I found in the book is that a lot of the people who are more activists, Dorothy Dix was one of them. She was a very active suffragist. But in her column, she kind of toes sort of a more centrist line. She's sort of not using it to sort of advance her own political agenda. And I think that was... You see that the most advice columnists, at least the most popular ones, you see their ideas change as time goes on. And you see them sort of feeling responsible for sort of vocalizing a centrist position, for sort of trying to articulate the norms of our society in as sort of generous a way as possible. Mm-hmm. I think advice columns generally have sort of a reputation for conservatism as sort of being a place where you're sort of told like how to behave, which is like I think not everyone wants to be told how to behave. But I think what you also see is it being a space where people are sort of figuring out the norms of our society, and where it being a sort of a public forum for people to sort of, you know, where they can see it, sort of witness these norms changing.
One advice column that I tend to read when I'm eating my lunch or something like that is Dear Prudence on uh-huh. Slate. And it used to be written by someone named Mallory Ortberg, who is now Daniel Mallory Ortberg. And he has transitioned into a man. And in the column, a lot of people, it seems, feel very comfortable asking questions about being transgender and being in relationships that might not be traditional ones. And I think about people reading that who might not have people in their lives who are living those experiences. But by reading them, it gives them that insight into what that person might be feeling and experiencing.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that it is sort of a window into the various lives many people lead. And one thing I found about the individuals who have given advice in our society over the last three centuries is that doing it sort of makes you more progressive over time. Like if you look at someone like Dr. Spock, like the very first edition of his book on babies was, you know, very conservative in terms of how he thought women should behave at home and how he saw the delegation of labor between husbands and wives. And sort of by the end of, you know, by the ninth edition, he was writing about gay couples and was writing about, you know, how to make sure that a woman can continue her career should she choose to. And I think there's something about being exposed to the hardships and questions and lifestyles of many people that is, you know, that does sort of open people's eyes. And also it's sort of a comfortable way to sort of learn about how other people live.
We're talking with Jessica Weisberg about her new book, Asking for a Friend, Three Centuries of Advice on Life, Love, Money, and Other Burning Questions from a Nation Obsessed.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you read advice columns? What do you get out of them? Do you have a favorite you'd like to tell us about? And have you ever written to one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now we're picking up our conversation with Jessica Weisberg. Her new book is Asking for a Friend, Three Centuries of Advice on Life, Love, Money, and Other Burning Questions from a Nation Obsessed.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a regular reader of an advice column in a newspaper or online? Do you put yourself more in the position of a person asking for advice or the one giving it? Have you ever followed the advice of a columnist when you weren't sure what to do? What is it that people like, and I guess we Americans like it more than others, what do we like about reading about other people's troubles? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
Jessica, as you researched these advice columnists from very different time periods, did you see any common personality traits that might indicate who is drawn to becoming an advice columnist?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of them are really idealists. Like, they really believe that they can make the world a better place. And they are also people with maybe not as much self-awareness as some others. I try to say that generously, but just people who are like able to put themselves in a position of like kind of the, of great potential embarrassment. Like, you are, it's a public platform where you're telling people what to do, and the stakes are real, and you're giving real people advice on really serious issues. So there's people with like and like a lot of confidence in their point of view, and maybe not always that much self-awareness. But like a lot of idealism, one thing I was really struck by in the book was that a lot of them, you know, are trying to help their individual readers, but they're also trying to make society a better place. And you really see that in, you know, like I mentioned William Alcott earlier, like he wanted to help you live till you were 100, but he also wanted to end slavery, and he wanted to make the world better by people being vegetarians. And Benjamin Franklin, who I also write about in the book, like he wanted to help you make money and be more productive, but he also was saying all these things so that American society would be a more industrious place. So you really see people who want to change the world and have a very particular view on how to do it.
Part of the title of your book is Advice on Life, Love, Money, and Other Burning Questions. One of the things I wondered is, as you look through the history of advice columns and the topics that were covered, did some broad topics seem really consistent that people wanted guidance on regardless of the century they were living in? And, you know, were they often the same, just adapted for the times?
Oh, absolutely. It's always been really hard to tell if someone likes you back. Like, it's just always been really hard. And like, you know, just questions about love and sex and relationships have always really troubled people. It's never been like being vulnerable in a relationship has never been easy.
And I'm sure that, you know, things have changed as, like you mentioned, women entered the workforce in large numbers in the 20th century. But I bet there were always, whether you were, you know, a woman working on the farm alongside your husband and raising your children, or a woman working in a World War II factory, there was work-life balance to think about.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think a lot of women have been grappling with similar kinds of guilt, even if like the equation of what makes them feel guilty has changed over time.
So who has been the target audience over these last three centuries? Were they writing specifically for one part of society, or did advice columnists always think that their words of wisdom could benefit everyone?
That's a great question. I think one thing I really have seen as I looked at the history of advice columnists is that early advice columnists were really writing for as broad an audience as possible. And, you know, they were also writing in the 20th century for major newspapers with millions of readers who were trying to hit as all Americans as much as possible. And as time goes on, you see that people's audiences are sort of becoming more targeted. And especially on the internet, you see audiences becoming sort of micro-targeted and sort of people seeking advice and giving advice to people who sort of demographically resemble themselves. But in the 20th century, you know, like Ann Landers and Dear Abby, they didn't really have much competition at the time. They were the advice columnists of that era.
And so do you see that trend continuing where, as you said, there are, first of all, a lot more places to find advice being given on the internet because the overhead is a lot lower than printing it in a paper or some other form? Do you think it's going to become more and more targeted? And are we losing something with that?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. I think that trend is certainly going to continue, certainly the way it's sort of continued with all media. I think in general, like, the media has become more of a sort of a space for targeted audiences, and the advice column is very much part of the history of the media. So yeah, I think it'll continue on that trend, and I think that the advantage of that, of course, is that it gives you an opportunity to find advice from people who maybe have more similar experiences to you. If you are a transgender person, there's more transgender people giving advice. And now at Slate, there's a transgender person being given a great big platform. But I think that's a huge advantage of it, that there's sort of more voices and more perspectives now on the internet because the overhead is lower. And then, you know, I think a certain disadvantage is that there's sort of a less loss of a shared norm or a shared values. And I think that sort of we see that in our culture beyond advice columns right now. I feel like there is a sort of fragmentation in our political and cultural life right now. And sort of the change in advice columns reflects that change more generally.
We're talking with Jessica Weisberg about her new book, Looking at the History of Advice Columns and Americans' Fascination with It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And advice columns and columnists have also made it into novels and movies and TV. Can you give us some examples of that, Jessica?
Sure. The famous one is Miss Lonely Hearts, the book that which is about an advice columnist who pretends to be like a very emotionally available woman when in fact he's sort of compulsive alcoholic man, and he writes these very cheesy letters to people experiencing deep sadness in their lives, and when in fact he's experiencing sadness himself that he's sort of refusing to deal with. And I think part of that portrayal sort of has created this idea of the advice columnist as sort of a hypocrite or as someone who's giving advice that he or she himself is unable to follow. And I think that you see that a little bit when you look at actual real advice columnists over the era. There's Dr. Spock, for instance, had some troubles with his own home life and sort of conflicts with his children. But in general, I have found at least that the vast majority of the advice columnists in the book were really trying to sort of live their best life and were very open to sort of sharing their vulnerabilities and doing the best they could. And in a lot of cases, really sharing with their readers when they slipped up and fell and weren't able to follow their own advice.
Well, and one of the things that I've noticed have happened with, for instance, Ann Landers or Dear Abby, they would give some advice and then they would get huge pushback from their readers, and they would often publish those and say, you know, I gave this advice and it's been pointed out that maybe I hadn't thought it through. And, you know, here's what I would say now. And that always struck me as, you know, a pretty humble thing to admit to.
Absolutely. I think that's a sign of a really good advice column, of someone who can sort of admit that their ideas are changing and that they're living in a fluid society and that norms are changing and the right thing to do is changing and that they don't know everything. And I think one thing that's sort of interesting about Dear Abby and Ann Landers in particular is that as time went on, like sort of studies show that people were like fewer of the letters that arrived to them were letters to Ann Landers and Dear Abby, and more of them were responses to other column, sort of other letters that had previously appeared in their column. And that what they did is they really fostered a community as much as sort of creating an advice column just for themselves. And think about how rare that was at the time, again, before the internet, for largely women, because that was their target audience, to be able to communicate with each other about all sorts of difficult major issues that they were facing in their lives.
Why do you think Americans in particular are so drawn to getting advice this way from a stranger who may or may not have any professional training or background in counseling?
I think it's a few things. One, I think it just sort of reflects the sort of American culture of optimism that, you know, with a little bit of advice and a point in the direction, we can do anything. So I think there's something very American about our love of advice. I think that it also sort of reflects the fact that we live in a society where we have more choices and to do things differently than maybe our parents did, and that we might need to seek advice outside of our immediate community. Maybe if you're the first person to go to college in your family, it's easier to seek advice from a stranger than it is from your parents. So I think that sort of the idea that we have more options in our society would bring people to advice columnists. And then, of course, the fact that we have a country without an organized religion. I think that also allows people to sort of seek wisdom in lots of different places.
Well, Jessica, thanks so much for joining us today. It was really interesting.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jessica Weisberg is an award-winning writer and producer. Her new book is called Asking for a Friend, 3 centuries of advice on life, love, money, and other burning questions from a nation obsessed. And you can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us if you enjoy advice columns.
Wisconsin State Fair cream puffs are delicious, messy, and famous here in Wisconsin. We here at Wisconsin Public Radio know this. It is known.
But now the cream puffs are getting attention from our colleagues at National Public Radio.
NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday, and she filed a piece from this year's State Fair. She went through the production process to help make a cream puff.
And then, of course, she got to eat the cream puff she had made. She got advice from fairgoers on the best way to tackle the messy cream puff, and then she went for it.
So I'm now obviously going to eat my cream puff. I believe in getting messy, so I'm going to eat it like a sandwich. Here we go. Wow. That is delicious. This is absolutely wonderful, and I made this.
So, yeah, cream puffs, great. I haven't been to the State Fair this year. I don't think I'm going to make it, so I'm going to be cream puffless. And it wouldn't be the same to eat, even if somebody brought one to you, not the same.
Right. There is a bakery in my neighborhood that has cream puffs that I think are almost as big as the State Fair ones. They look delicious, but, you know, some things you just have to go for the original.
And our own J. Carlisle Larson was at the fair and said she did have her first, I think, State Fair cream puff and liked it, but was quite embarrassed at how messy she got while eating it. And it's like, yes, you were the only person there.
The only one.
Covered in the filling.
Well, and I have to say, it's not as good as a cream puff, but a good funnel cake is good, and there's no way to avoid getting the powdered sugar all over you, at least if you're me.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.